I think that social media brought us that, right? I think that we lived in a world that was, in recent history, designed around binaries, designed around adversaries, because one story was the only story that was allowed to dominate. So you really could debate the finer points because the big story wasn't in question by the people who controlled everything. I feel like social media unearthed and brought back storytelling and different traditions and put them in front of people who would never encounter them otherwise. And I think that's where we're seeing this resurgence, is that people who never were part of a storytelling tradition are seeing them being uncovered or brought back to life in front of them and going, that resonates with me far more deeply than the stories I've been told my whole life. I want to be part of stories where we help each other and we work together to care for our planet and where we all matter and not just some of us.
This week I'm joined by Lauren Hugg, a writer, speaker, and an activist based in Colorado Springs. Lauren grew up with a unique mix of influences, a tech-savvy household, a love of the humanities, and a conservative religious upbringing. It sparked in her a deep curiosity about ideas and a passion for rediscovering and sharing the wisdom of the past. Lauren has focused much of her work on promoting digital kindness and encouraging healthier ways of interacting online. While social media often gets a bad rap, Lauren actually sees its potential for amplifying new voices and stories. Through her writing and speaking and online presence, she inspires people to engage with more empathy, seek out different perspectives, and use digital platforms to spread uplifting content. It's a wide-ranging discussion, and Lauren opens up about her journey of unlearning default mindsets, coping with anxiety, and defining herself in her own terms. She shares her optimism about younger generations and her excitement about the creative potential made possible by emerging technologies. I think you'll find Lauren's perspective refreshing and thought-provoking. Now, over to Lauren. Lauren, welcome to the Impossible Network podcast.
Hi, glad to be here.
And where are you?
I'm in Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Oh, that sounds delightful.
It's very pretty.
Anyway, shall we jump in and start with the big question?
Let's do it.
Okay. Who are you, Lauren, as a human being?
I think that'd be an easy question to answer, but it's not. It's funny. I thought I had an answer. Now I'm like, I'm a thinker. I like to think about things, read about things, come up with new ways of approaching things. And more I'm discovering, I like finding old ways, ways that have been obscured or hidden or just diminished over time. Instead of like, finding the new thing, rediscovering the things that have already been done. And I hesitate when I answer questions like that because I have never, I am a mother, I have two children, but I usually never start with that. And I almost never start with my job either because I've become more and more conscious of how we define ourselves by these very specific roles instead of our holistic beings. So I've tried to become more conscious of how to answer that.
And that is the purpose of the question, to get away from us. When we sit down and we meet people, we tend to, whether it be in a new social setting or networking, like, hey, what is it you do? Where do you come from? And we don't really get to know who people really are that we're around and connecting with. And it's important for us to understand who we are as human beings. And also, it is a hard question to really reflect and sit down and go, who am I? You know,
I like the question because it's not easy to answer.
So the old ways, why the old ways?
I think because I grew up in kind of a tech forward home. My dad was an early programmer and it was always about new and better instead of what came before. So like a lack of, I'm not saying I was raised with a lack of understanding, but I always felt like I was in a society that was always new, shiny, better, bigger, faster. Instead of saying a lot of these things that we need to learn and understand have been known by people for millennia before us, and that it's time to like listen to that wisdom that was passed down through generations that doesn't always show up in technology or doesn't show up in even in our recorded history books, right? Like that, but shows up in the way that we teach our children how to do something. We don't even know why we're doing it. We just know that we learned it from our grandmother or something. And it's just the way we do it. So I've been a lot more mindful about all of these different ways of knowing and being that have been excluded from discourse for a long time because they don't meet the standards of proof or the standards of academic review or any of the systems that we've designed that tell us what is worth knowing and tell us how we know things, but that have excluded all sorts of learnings and people and traditions. So rediscovering those, or at least trying to find the things that are being obscured by the things we're all used to.
It's very interesting. And as you were talking and mentioning your children, I'm sure, and I've heard people talk about this in other interviews, the observation of just the impact of the pandemic on children mm-hmm. in terms of the things that we have taken for granted, as you say, passed down from our elders to us in terms of our behaviors around our discourse and how do we connect. And that forced isolation is going to have a long-lasting impact on a generation of children that we might never discover ways to naturally have discourse with other people and maybe have a negative legacy on their lives. So I think it's really interesting to be conscious of the value and the wisdom in maybe the old ways of living and the universal, well, this universal wisdom that makes us human. And as we enter a world of AI, how important is it going to be for us to retain the essence of us as humans? And that will force us to delve back into probably some of the great traditions of different societies that have made us, you know, to reproduce, to build connection, community. And that's something I think we'll come on and talk about as well in terms of the work that you're doing. So I suppose it's a nice way to start. That leads to then next question. If you're so cognizant of the old ways and the importance to remember and to celebrate and to pass on that wisdom of the way that we should live and the way that we should connect as human beings, what do you think has led you to be that person and that thinker that you are?
My mom is a teacher. She was a speech English drama teacher. And like I said, my dad is a programmer. So I had this tech plus humanities mm-hmm. kind of background at home. I used to have friends come over. They thought it was so funny that we would be debating like history or Shakespeare at the dinner table. And I thought that was normal, that that's what people normally did. And it is for some people, but not for everybody. So I always read. I always went to plays. My parents were very, they took us to museums. They made sure that we went to cultural centers. And I don't know that I really, like, I liked the reading side of things. I didn't fully understand art. And I didn't understand necessarily other forms of human expression. Words were always the ones that really resonated with me. And I think that's why I was drawn to things like law or philosophy or any kind of writing, right? And as I've gotten older now, I'm like, oh, how do these things get expressed through other forms of human expression? And where do they overlap and how do they intersect? And I'm, you know, a beginner and learning about a lot of these things because it's just not where my strengths were. But I've loved ideas. I've loved words. When I was 8 years old, I think, we used to have those scholastic book fairs at our school where you could go buy books. And the very first book I ever bought with my own money was a thesaurus. And I still have it somewhere and it gets dog-eared and there's underlining and there's all, and I used to love finding other words for things. I have no idea why that was the thing that I wanted most when I was that age. But so words have always interested me. And then as I started to understand that words have different meanings to different people, how do you communicate then? And if you go too far down certain routes, you get to where, well, we can't communicate because we're never meaning the same thing and we're never experiencing the same thing. And I sort of dabbled in that like area of thought for a little while. And I was like, no, there are ways for us to ensure that we're being understood. We might not ever have exactly the same understanding, but we can find common ground to understand each other through so many different ways. I was thinking about this the other night that we went to see the musical Come From Away. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Have you heard of it?
No. No.
It's based on the September 11th when all of the planes had to be diverted from U.S. airspace. They landed 28 or so in Newfoundland. And it's a story of how these people in this area, this very remote area with small numbers of people, like their population almost doubled overnight by all these people on planes landing. And these people were planes from all around the world. And this is before most people had cell phones. So most people had no idea what had actually happened. why they were being diverted. And some people were stuck on planes for like more than a full day just sitting on the ground. And so anyway, there's a scene in the play where there's a bus load of people that have been diverted from Africa. And they're trying to be respectful that the Newfoundlanders, I'm not saying it right. So they're dressed up in like their Salvation Army uniforms. But the people from Africa are scared because where they're coming from, soldiers are not a good sign, right? And it's dark and they're going on this bus really far away. And the way that the musical shows how they communicate is somebody, one of the bus drivers or somebody's trying to be nice and be like, it's fine, you know, and the family is scared, but they're holding a Bible. And so I'm going to cry. I cry every time. I see this musical three times and I can't even talk about the scene without crying. But he turns to one verse and he points to like, be not anxious, right? Do not be afraid, basically.
Wow.
And they say that's how we started speaking the same language. Wow. I'm like, there you go.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Incredible. I have to find that play then. Is it just a play or a movie as well?
It's just it's a musical. I don't know if they'll turn it into a movie or not, but yeah.
Okay. Let's go on the list and go on the show notes. Okay. That's cool. Yeah. So that upbringing of the humanities meets tech and your fascination in words, what was that early? How did that sort of worldview develop? I mean, you grew up in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
After I was 12. Southern California until I was 12, Texas after. Yeah.
Yeah. So as you were sort of growing up and your thesaurus at age 8, fascination for words, how did you view the world and what were your expectations and ambitions back then?
Ugh. When I was around the same age, when I was 8, the thing I wanted to be more than anything in the world was the first female baseball player. I wanted to play for the Angels.
That's a bit of a diversion away from a love of words.
Well, I also wanted to be an actress, but it was sort of secondary. I mean, I was obsessed with softball for a period of years. But then once I got older, right, it was more, I wanted to be an actress. I wanted to go into theater and was very much encouraged not to do that because, you know, the whole, that thing we all get told that it's not practical or that you're never going to be able to make a living in it. I wanted to be an author. That was the other thing. I was going to be a writer. Writer, actress, those were the two things I was most interested in. And both were things that my parents were like, no, you have to do something real is what their attitude was. And so it was, my parents and I have had many conversations about it since then, because with me raising my children, I'm very encouraging of their artistic pursuits. Mm-hmm. My daughter is an artist. And it's so interesting to me to be able to say my daughter is an artist, right? I don't say my daughter likes art. She likes artsy things. My daughter is an artist in a way that it's still hard for me to say I am a writer. I have books. I have proof. And I still, like, it's a hobby. It's very hard for me to say that it's my real job.
But you studied journalism.
I did. Well, that was the practical way of being a writer, right?
Yeah.
That's a job. Being a journalist is a job where you write.
Mm-hmm.
I can go write the Great American Novel or something. And even then, I was practical and was looking at the starting salaries for journalism when I was coming out of college. I'm not sure that they have changed much, actually. And was like, no, that's like, who lives off? You can't live off of that. So I ended up in law school again. Mm-hmm. And I jokingly say, one of my friends sent me a meme or something the other day about like litigation. It was hilarious. It was like, litigation is just community theater with consequences. And I was dying laughing because it's a joke that all trial lawyers are frustrated actors because you all wanted to be theater people, but you couldn't pay your bill.
I wonder if that litigation is just theater with consequences will ring true for Donald Trump. We'll see.
I mean, a lot of what he does is community theater without consequences so far. So.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. I'm just wondering. When will the consequences part kick in?
Yeah.
So aside from that diversion. So yeah, your parents must be very happy that you ended up sort of with that grand ambition to be a baseball playing actress, ended up as a journalist major come lawyer.
Yeah, no, actually, my dad was very sad that I went to law school. He didn't want me to be a lawyer. Oh. He was like, lawyers aren't good people. Why would you want to go to law school? I mean, his real hope was that I would actually do something tech, right? Like, he tried so hard to get me to be interested in the tech side of the world. Now I tease him. I'm like, well, I kind of do tech stuff, Dad. I talk about social media And he's like, that's not the same thing.
I mean, that time of transition from California to Texas and your emerging worldview and your ambitions, were there any other sort of, looking back at it, any other really defining life experiences that made you the person you are?
I mean, yeah? The church was the backbone of everything in my life, right? So I've been in therapy for years now. I'm a big believer in therapy. I will do a shout out for that. I think everybody should spend some time in it. But I started to realize I had a very unusual combination because I had this humanities thing and technology. So we were embracing new technologies and we were always, my family, embracing new technologies. Like I had a PC when I was 5. I was very early adopter. Like I learned to type before I learned to write by hand. And so we were always embracing the new technologies where that doesn't often go hand in hand with a very fundamentalist type of religious view. And the humanities as well. So museums and plays and theater and all this other stuff, like that doesn't always go hand in hand with a conservative religious worldview. But I had both. So I was growing up with technology and humanities and also a very conservative, very fundamentalist religious perspective, which was probably the dominant perspective in my life for a long time. Like no matter how much I read, no matter how many things I experienced or how many cultural conversations I had, I was still completely rooted in a very restrictive religious belief system. And it took a long time to untangle that for me.
Do you think that when you talk about how you're drawn to the old ways, do you think that is a remnant of the conservative religious upbringing that you had? An appreciation, respect for
tradition,
principles. Yeah.
When I talk about old ways, I'm thinking more about like indigenous or pagan or those types of ways, like way ancient.
Yeah.
That I feel like, at least, and I'm again a beginner, I don't want to talk like I have any knowledge of any of this because it's very removed from my upbringing. It's very removed from my cultural experience myself. But just tapping the little I've done to scratch the surface, it just seems to have had better insights into like our relationships with nature, our relationships with other species, that we sort of, the world I grew up in was very human-centric and isolated in so many ways. It didn't see connections the way that I feel like traditions I didn't grow up in might. But since I can't speak eloquently to any of them because I'm still sort of just a tourist trying to figure this stuff out.
So when you said that you've been through therapy, do you think there was a negative impact on you as a human, as you being Lauren, the real you? Was it impacted by that religious upbringing?
Oh, 100%.
In what way?
Well, I mean, there's very defined roles specifically for women. And
which church?
I grew up in what we would have called a Bible church. So non-denominational, but very much steeped in the ideas of, if anybody's seen the documentary Shiny Happy People, like the Quiverful stuff and the Bill Goddard, I'm not even pronouncing his name right because it didn't come up, but you can see the principles show up. But this idea that, you know, man is the head of the household, the spiritual leader, the in charge of everything. Wife goes underneath that, then does children under them. And really nothing above him, except maybe God. But and the thing that's been really, really interesting is talking to my parents. That's not the kind of tradition they grew up in. There was a very concerted effort to inculcate these ideas, to put these ideas in through churches. And a lot of people that have grown up with like more like what you're talking about, traditional religion, didn't have any idea that that was happening, that there was this social engineering happening. And a lot of their kids, my generation, ended up with it. And I think this is fairly accurate, figured that out when we started raising our own kids and went, no, we're not doing that. And so there's been this sort of reaction of like, this way that we were raised was not okay. And so it's been interesting to talk to my parents about, like, they didn't realize how much of it we were getting through youth group and other places because youth was so isolated from the rest of the churches.
So if you had that sort of social engineering through the church, I'm sure when you were growing up and you were at school and going to university, you saw a very different side of the world. So presumably, couldn't you just leave that leave that legacy behind?
I wish.
Hence the role of therapy.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what a lot of people don't necessarily understand, and it's something about finding the common ground, right, to speak to people who don't have this experience and don't understand why it's not easy to leave, is that part of that whole worldview is that you're going to be persecuted and nobody's going to understand you. And it's going to be very hard to be a follower of Christ. And only a small subset of people get it. And so it was a very weird thing to be able to have this curiosity about the world and to read and learn and do all these things. Because I was active on the newspaper. I was active in speech and debate. I went to University of Texas. These were not conservative space. But I was always holding on to that, like, you're different kind of thing. Like, this is all well and good and it's all very interesting, but it isn't the truth. And so I never had the kind of, like, a lot of times when we think about conservative or fundamentalist religion, we think about people that are like screaming outside of abortion clinics, right? Or that are standing on street corners yelling at people. And that was never part of my personal upbringing. My parents were never like that. My home was a place where anybody was welcome. So it was weird. It was this like very conflicting perspectives. And I think that that's ultimately what it enabled me to figure some of this stuff out later on in life, is that the more I started to realize that the tradition that I had grown up in was not aligned with the empathy and compassion and love for fellow human beings that I actually have and believe in, it became easier to say, I've always been this person. All this other stuff is the problem, not the part of me that loves other people and wants to understand other people and learn about other people and find new and interesting ways to do things. That's all consistent with my faith. It's the execution of it in certain spaces that is really problematic and that I don't align with at all.
So the third big question is, what are you working to achieve before we all shuffle off this mortal coil? And the reason I'm intrigued to go from that point of discussion around the sort of the inner conflict with the impact of the church, that you could have just buried it, lived with it, gone to therapy and carried on as a lawyer, a mother. But you've sort of gone down a slightly different path and are definitely embracing and living your principles through your writing and through your activism and through your consulting as well. So perhaps you could talk about that big question and what it is you're working to affect or change in the world.
So the big question, a couple of years ago, I sat down and I was like, what do I really want to do? Right. Especially with my background and the things that I know. And I spent my law degree, I concentrated on constitutional law. And then I got a master's of law at University College London in international human rights, legal theory and jurisprudence, and comparative human rights. I forget. It was a long time ago. Comparative something. And
And your dad still said lawyers don't do good. I mean, if you're working one part of law that is actually doing good, human rights. Come on.
And no, he actually didn't want me to go to London. He was like, why do you need another law degree? Scholarship, daddy, scholarship. And I get to live in London for a year. But when I started to sit down and think, okay, our systems are broken. Or, I mean, depending on how you look at it, our systems are broken or they're doing exactly what they were designed to do, which was to allow certain people to be able to do whatever they wanted while other people served them. And that as we've had an increasing concept of who belongs and who is allowed to have a voice and who matters, the strain on systems that weren't designed for all sorts of different people is showing up more and more. So from a systemic perspective, I started thinking, okay, how do I use what I know about systems and policy to make a difference? And I kept coming back to, well, there has to be a mindset shift first, right? Like, I can go sit in think tanks or write white papers or go back to academia, but until most of us understand it, it's going to be kind of an insular conversation amongst people with access and power and won't fold in everybody else. And we've done that, in my opinion, for long enough that wasn't the route that I felt particularly called to do. Like, that didn't seem to be my space, because I've thought about it at various points in time. Would I go back to university? Would I get a PhD in I don't know, like now there's all sorts of things I could study that didn't exist back when I was in school about things like social media and social change, stuff like that, that wasn't even on the radar when I was in school. But the more I thought about it, I was like, I already have these tools. Why don't I just use them to tell a different story about who we are and what we can be in this world? And since we all now have our own media companies in our own hand, every single one of us can reach huge numbers of people. We don't always reach huge number of people, but we can. What would it look like if we purposefully use these tools that we usually talk about as being bad and terrible and awful to show a different world, or to show what we want people to know about, or to show the kinds of kindness that we want to see in the world? I mean, it's that whole be the change you want to see, but here you can do it on an epic scale, because anything that any of us put out at any point in time can be amplified to many, many more people. So that was just sort of how I started thinking along these lines. What can I do from where I'm at right now, right now, without having to learn anything new, without having to build anything new? And I just started using my social platforms for that. And then that turned into books and speaking and other things as I saw it resonated with some people.
But what triggered that? What made you so consciously aware of the fact that you could have just ended up in an echo chamber talking to the converted, rather than actually taking a step back and looking at it as at a system level?
I think just knowing how I changed. I didn't change because of academia. As you pointed out, I went to an excellent public high school. I went to an excellent public university. I went to an excellent postgraduate in London. I was surrounded by brilliant people. I was confronted with all sorts of brilliant ideas, and I rejected pretty much all in favor of what I already knew. So it isn't that. What changed me was people, like seeing the impact of my beliefs on actual humans and seeing that, okay, this sounds okay in some sort of abstract way. I can kind of see how that makes some sense. But when I'm standing in front of a person whom it actually very clearly harms, now I need to rethink my principles. Because if the thing that I believe leads to that outcome, I'm not so sure I want to believe that anymore, even if it makes perfect logical sense, even if it aligns with all this other stuff. If it is hurting a human being in a very demonstrable way, I mean, I'm not even getting into like maybe ways, like very clear ways, it's time to rethink. So I think people change because of getting to know other human beings and seeing how we're connected and how the things that we do, and especially the things that we think impact other people, and the things that we say impact other people.
Was there a moment when you became abundantly aware of that? You talk about demonstrable damage to someone. Was there one incident?
No, there was one. I mean, I know once I became pregnant with my first child, I'd seen for years statistics on how not belonging impacts LGBTQ individuals, right? Like, but when it was mine, my child, suddenly it hit home in a way that had never hit home before, that I can read data and I would like to not have a situation where a child that I am bringing into the world does not feel loved, doesn't feel safe, doesn't feel like they belong, and or their friends, right? Like anybody. And then it spirals from there. Like logically, okay, wait a minute. If I don't want this for my kid, why would I want this for anybody else's kid? And now I need to change everything I think about this particular issue. So that's one of the, in America, I don't know if it's controversial other places, controversial issues about a human being existing as themselves that we've turned into a political football that is a non-political issue as far as I'm concerned. It has nothing to do with politics and shouldn't be used as a political point in any way. But it used to logically make sense to me that this was a thing that we should be legislating about. But the more that, the more I thought about it, the more I know people who, like every time we have a bathroom debate, it affects real human beings and never any of the people that the people are arguing about, ever. And so I started to get a lot more clear on like, wait a minute, these things that I thought were important don't impact me at all. In no way impact my life. but very much impact the lives of people that I know and people that I care about. And so I had to start getting more clear about if I truly do love people, which I say I do, I have to show up differently in this world. And I need to be more, and I need to be more aware of and invested in the safety and health and well-being of all of my fellow human beings, not just particular groups that I understand or that I identify with, but everybody.
It sounds like you went almost embraced a first principles way of thinking about what it means to be a human.
You might have to clarify that for me.
Well, just the way that when you're solving problems in engineering or physics and going to first principles to take things down to their basic sort of fundamental principles of solving a problem or looking at an issue, deconstructing something down into its the smallest parts possible and then building from there. By starting to rethink at a first principle level, words like you're using in the books you've written around kindness and grace and things like empathy, what it is to have respect for other humans, regardless of where they come from, their upbringing, whatever their perspective, their politics. It feels like that's what the process you went through. Well, so what was it then that led you to actually sit down and then just start typing away and creating your first book? And why were you so focused on the behavior of people in the digital realm rather than in the physical realm?
I can see how the digital realm amplifies everything, right? It enables us to have more reach than we would have in physical spaces. That's what interested me. And I think what I thought it was so weird, because I always loved social media. And I thought it was so odd that it was so negative, that people talk about it so negatively all the time. And all of the stories you read about it, you read about how bad it is, you read about the studies that hurt people, all this. And then occasionally you'll read stories about it doing some amazing good, but it won't be focused on social media. It'll be like, oh, these people organized to do this thing. And it's like, well, that was only possible because of social media. But that isn't what the focus of the story is on. And so it's like, this is this invisible thing that has dramatically changed our lives, I think, for the better. Specifically, my life is so much better because I could access all of these ideas that I couldn't access within my physical circles that changed me, right? So, I mean, I started to change on behalf of other people long before I changed on behalf of myself, before I started to see that maybe I needed to be in a different environment and a different space, not just that I needed to believe different things. So it was actually I did a TEDx talk on the power of kindness in the digital world. And that was actually the first time I put these ideas together. I was thinking about how valuable it had been in my life and why everybody was saying there's something negative about it. Specifically, I talk about my first book, Digital Kindness. I moved from Austin to Colorado Springs. I was planning a move from Austin to Colorado Springs. And the house I was going to buy was in the middle of a wildfire. And like 346 houses had burned down. It was huge. I mean, it was a huge fire. And I'd already made connections. This is when Twitter was still fun. Just to ask questions about things like preschools or, you know, where do you grocery shop or just basic stuff. Mm-hmm. And when the fire happened, it was amazing how everybody was so connected and responding to each other and built this community digitally that they weren't connected physically yet. I mean, they lived in the same physical geographical space, but they didn't necessarily know each other in real life, in physical world. I try to say physical instead of real. And I just watched this community come together in a way that I hadn't really seen it before. And even though the house we were going to buy couldn't buy, the whole area was a disaster area, and hadn't sold the house in Austin yet, I just had this sense that this is where I physically wanted to be because of the digital community that I was already part of. And I got here and had coffee within the first 2 days of living here with somebody I'd talked to, who's now a very, very dear friend of mine. And just saw the connection between the physical and the digital world and how they intersect and play together. So for me, I was like, this is awesome. This is the greatest thing ever. I don't understand why everybody keeps talking about how bad it is. I was watching economic empowerment happen in front of me. I was watching, you know, people that had limited opportunities in physical world spaces be able to do all sorts of things in digital world spaces. So all of that sort of combined to be like, my initial thought and the initial TEDx talk, the initial book was, well, let's just be nicer. The only problem in these spaces is that we're not being nice enough. So can we actually think about how we interact with people digitally? Because people will say it's the anonymity, or, you know, there's all these reasons why people think people are mean online in ways that they might not be mean in the physical world. Though I think now we're seeing, well, actually, the meanness online spills out into the physical world, and we're seeing more meanness in the physical world than we might have seen previously. So anyway, that was my thought was, hey, the reason y'all don't understand how great this is because everybody's being mean to each other. How about we just try being nice and then we'll know it's a really great thing.
Do you think when you say that it's spilling out into the physical world, do you think that's a result of behavior change and it's becoming more acceptable to display these types of behaviors in the physical world than it was before because of? So it's a causation rather than a correlation thing. It's because of the behaviors that have been encouraged, facilitated, whatever, by bad actors, polarized media, all these other factors that have gone into it. When there are forces that are at play that are out with our individual control, then it's very easy to say, yes, let's behave better. But how do you individually you can change, but how do you drive collective adoption of these behaviors against these negative forces that are creating these externalities that we're seeing, whether it be the anxiety and youth, a generation of young girls that Jonathan Haidt just wrote about in his new book, whether you believe it or not. I know it's caused some sort of a differences of opinion, but clearly we're seeing the suicide rates up amongst teenagers. We're seeing angry young men emerging. Yes, I agree with you. We should all behave, be a lot more respectful, responsible, kind, considerate, thoughtful, take time for pause and reflect before shooting off a tweet or whatever it's called now, or an Instagram post. But it is hard to do. And, you know, it's how do you start to engender that sort of that change at scale?
I think that it's why it's important for us to use social media spaces to tell truths that mm-hmm. haven't been told. I find Jonathan Haidt fascinating. He absolutely hates social media. And I think it's because he's a beneficiary of a world that existed without it. And it's not a game changer for him. Yeah. Where it is a massive game. I mean, like, it's only a game changer in making the world different, not better for him. Whereas I mm-hmm. think it's a massive game changer when you look at people that are, for a long time, didn't have voices and didn't have access, who now do, and who can collectively organize. And yes, that's going to disrupt the societies as we've known them. So I think, one, yes, we have some bad actors that are incentivizing really bad behavior and are getting mm-hmm. away with it and are normalizing it. And that's problematic. And I do think that social media contributes to that because it's transmitting it and amplifying it in places that it might not have otherwise been transmitted or amplified. At the same time, though, I think that social media has created outlets for people that didn't have voices or who couldn't be heard outside their circles to now be heard far and wide. So I think what we're seeing has far more to do with the fact that when people say we don't know how to be civil anymore, civil discourse was reserved for people who are basically similarly situated. And for a long time, the people that got to decide what civil discourse were, they might have quibbled on a few things, but they weren't very dramatically situated differently. Now we're having conversations across all sorts of cultures and all sorts of lived experiences, all at the same table, or not the same table, but in the same space. Mm-hmm. And that's causing a lot of people to be very uncomfortable with the realities that they thought they knew that aren't quite right. And I think about the fact that I went to one of our top 20 law schools, and I didn't know that the Nazis had studied our race laws to make their race laws until I read Caste just a few months ago. Like, we're not telling the truth. It's about how we constructed our systems and who was allowed to have a say and how dramatically and intentionally we created systems that kept others out or certain people out. So I think that a lot of the conflict that we're seeing is that the rules of civil discourse were set by people who had a seat at the table, and they're demanding people behave when that's not the appropriate response for some people, given where they are situated and what they are dealing with. And so I struggled with that a lot when I was writing Digital Grace of like, okay, when do you confront and when do you grant grace? How do you know when it's a time that you shouldn't be courteous because it's something that is so beyond the bounds of courtesy that to behave in a courteous way is an acquiescence. And I don't have answers to it, but I sort of came up with a couple of ideas of like, if you're in a position of power, that's when you're supposed to be exercising courtesy. If it's not something that is deeply and personally related to anything that you're experiencing, courtesy and grace, right? If you feel safe saying whatever you think about a topic, that's the time when you should be exercising courtesy and grace. If there's no risk to you to air your opinion, then you need to err on the side of courtesy and grace. And I think by thinking through those things, like, wait, is this something that I'm actually, am I taking any risk when I say this? Or am I allowed to just say whatever I want because of the space that I occupy in this particular topic? Maybe that's time for me to listen then. If I can say whatever I want with no consequences, this is a time and a space where I should be listening. We could list, you know, there's so many things happening. We are at such a transition time right now. There's so much change and different voices and different stories and different perspectives and different ideas out there now. And the narrative's no longer controlled by a handful of people. I mean, they still control a lot of it, but not all of it. So it's a difficult process to be engaged in. When should I not speak? When should I listen? When should I grant grace? When should I? And I don't, like I said, I don't have answers, but I think there are things we should be thinking about.
There's a lot in there. I mean, I know we both know John Alexander. Mm-hmm. John has so perfectly captured the essence of the story we've all lived for the last century, the consumer story. And also the story that comes before that, which is the subject story, where we as humans operate as subjects to dictators, kings, fiefdoms that dictate what we should do and how we should behave and what we should think and what we should say. And when he talked and wrote the book Citizens about consumer story, I remember thinking about at the time I don't know if you know the British documentary filmmaker Adam Curtis.
I don't think so.
No, you should watch some of his documentaries online. They're fantastic. So there's one called The Century of the Self. And, you know, he looks at, goes back to things like Rousseau and Hobbes, the Hobbesian philosophy of what the role of society is and the Rousseau, the French philosopher's view. And I think what Curtis does in The Century of Self gives you a sense of why John's right with the consumer story. We're all conditioned to think we have agency. We are individuals to pursue our happiness at the expense of everything else. That is what we are as our role of human beings. And what it does is it's a abrogation of a responsibility as citizens, as part of communities, which actually, if you go back to the old story, which he calls a citizen story, the oldest story, when we lived together, the old ways and the ancient times, we survived because we worked as a unit, as a collective, as a community, as cooperative neighbors. And we've lost that. And I think that when you actually translate that into the discourse, the coarse discourse that occurs in social media, everyone thinks they've got a voice. Everyone knows we have a media channel. We have a platform. We have a megaphone to express what we think. We have a right to express our feelings, to say what we think, because it's been conditioned in us, and not to actually take pause and reflection and think about the impact on others and the fact that it can create conflict as a result of it. Mm-hmm. It's been conditioned out of us. And I think we have to recondition ourselves as human beings to think differently. And I think the challenge of what you're talking about is, I totally agree with it. How do we translate that the natural way that we are more respectful most of the time in the physical space into a digital space with almost a set of digital etiquettes?
Yeah, I mean, you're asking the questions. Those are the questions I was asking myself, right? I'm like, I don't see enough work in this space, so I'm just gonna throw some stuff out there and see if it helps people, because I facilitate in physical spaces all the time. I try to apply some of those concepts to digital spaces. I think, though, that you hit on something that's really important, too, about how we behave online. I think we inherited it as a technology, not as a human connection. So we think about it the way we think about computers and phones and not, this is me talking to you. It just happens to be over a laptop. It's different somewhat than us sitting in a cafe face to face, but it's not so different from that it's an entirely different experience than connecting with a human. Mm-hmm. So I think we allowed it, we think about it as technology instead of as human connection, which is one reason we behave differently. And the other thing that we did with online spaces is we created, it essentially became the comments section for newspapers, and it lent itself to debate instead of dialogue. Mm-hmm. And those are two things that I think are problematic, that it's, if you think of it as a technology, you get all up in your head about stuff. I was having a conversation with somebody recently, actually an Air Force commander of a huge support unit. And she kept using the word human work. This is the human work. This is, and I was like, I love that you keep emphasizing this is human stuff. Like, yes, this is logistics and it's tactical and it's a lot of moving pieces, but ultimately it's humans moving the pieces. And when we think about it as people, suddenly it's not as hard. It's not as hard. And we're like, oh, I'm talking to a person. So whether we analogize it to our living room, we know how we behave in our living room. We know how we behave if we're in a public setting, like a theater. If we think about it like that, it becomes a lot easier to think about how we would like to behave in these spaces and what we would want to put in them and interact with each other. So I like to get away from the debate concept of, I think one of the most problematic things we have created over the past few centuries is this absolute pedestaling of debate and argumentation. That's what changes people's minds. I mean, it doesn't. And yet it's baked into so many of our systems. We have presidential debates. We have all sorts of ways of where the goal is to show that you're smarter than, or you have the better idea than. They're not built around consensus building or around collaborative solution seeking. They're built around domination and adversarial concepts.
It's actually really funny when you think about, when you say that, because I love watching a good debate, but I've never been drawn to being part of a debate. But I was drawn to advertising. I was drawn to advertising, which is the power of persuasion. Because of the power of because of humor and because of wit and because of you realizing that you don't ever change someone's opinion or their behavior through the rational. You do it through the emotional. And the way you tap into the emotions is through all these different characteristics that you can actually, how you tell stories. So debate isn't storytelling. It's logic. And with you go back to Aristotle and you've got logos, pathos, and ethos. It's pathos is what, you know, with advertising, it's so driven by that. Mm-hmm. And again, going back to John and his citizen story, we tell stories. We got to start telling stories. And maybe that's what the role of how we have to change social media is, making it more of a storytelling platform. And maybe that's why platforms like LinkedIn are better, because people do tell stories on there. But it definitely feels like you are totally aligned that the debate is not, how do we get away from debate, and which is about naturally binary, you know, right, wrong. There isn't. We live in a ambiguous, fuzzy world of full of ambiguity and uncertainty. And as the sooner we embrace this ambiguity of the world and be less certain. I had a guest on there and one of them said, what's the most important thing we have to sort of learn, it is to be less certain mm-hmm. all the time. Because as soon as you're certain, and I think it was Arno Michaelis, who was an ex-Nazi skinhead guy who was totally transformed. Mm-hmm. And I think that was his what he said. And I thought it really resonated, because too many people are certain, you know, on both sides, mm-hmm. you know, whether it be in Israel-Palestine, whether it be issues around what's happening with Russia and Ukraine. That's the world, the reality of the world is it's not simple. It's not black and white. It's not binary. Mm-hmm. And social media, I think, and our media, mainstream media, it encourages and facilitates the exaggeration of these binary views.
See, I think that the binary views were existent in all of our systems already, that they were built mm-hmm. around binary views. We built adversarial systems because, I mean, especially in America.
But that's because, going back to John's point about the consumer story, because it was about power mm-hmm. and it was about control, the same with the subject story. But go way back in time to, as you call, the old ways and to the ancients, where people lived in different sort of social constructs. Maybe it was different. And maybe we just see a different way now, that there are different social constructs open to us, mm-hmm. whether they be cooperative movements, where they be, you know, citizen type, centric, flatter societies that are not hierarchical, that they are more, it's difficult because democracy is now such a loaded word. Right. going back to your whole thing about words being misinterpreted by different people. But yeah, it's interesting.
I think that social media brought us that, right? I think that we lived in a world that was, in recent history, designed around binaries, designed around adversaries, because one story was the only story that was allowed to dominate. So you really could debate the finer points because the big story wasn't in question by the people who controlled everything. I feel like social media unearthed and brought back storytelling and different traditions and put them in front of people who would never encounter them otherwise. And I think that's where we're seeing this resurgence, is that people who never were part of a storytelling tradition are seeing them being uncovered or brought back to life in front of them and going, that resonates with me far more deeply than the stories I've been told my whole life. I want to be part of stories where we help each other and we work together to care for our planet, and where we all matter, and not just some of us matter. Because it's a huge shift from the stories that we've been told. And it's why John's work is so important, because it is. That's a different story than what most of us were raised in. Gen Z is a different story completely, because they're being raised with more stories in the world.
What do you think will happen? I mean, you've got this conviction around that we need to change our discourse to be more kind, to embrace more grace. Where do you see it with the way, from what you're observing as a mother of two children, what's your sense of where the world will be 10 years from now?
If X and above doesn't blow the whole world up before Z and below get a chance to do the things that they're likely to do, I think that Z saves the world and Alpha does too. I think that I truly think that they are a different stage of evolution of humanity because of their interconnectivity. And they're a generation that has never known boundaries and statehood the way that previous generations did. And it doesn't make sense to them. See, and I get frustrated because, again, the only stories you ever hear about teens in social media are the negatives. You hear these outlier stories about the people that are struggling, and that, and I, every time the mental health of youth comes up, I want to point out that they are more aware of what is going on in the world than any previous generation was. And the story that they are told, if they don't access the more hopeful ones, isn't very hopeful. I think in a lot of ways, our youth have the most rational reactions to the current situation that we live in, because they see it for what it is. And they're not buying into the story that they need to sell their soul for a few possessions, because that's what gives you meaning in life. So it's hard, because there's very real things that are happening with youth. And at the same time, they are creating, they are connecting, they are organizing, they're doing it on their own terms. I had a friend ask after, I think, the midterms, she said something like, why does Gen Z hate business? And I was like, they don't hate business. They love micro business. They love social impact business. They love artists. They love creators. They don't like corporation.
Yeah.
That's not like, but the fact that you think that business means corporation is an interesting thing to me. So let's talk about that. And then she started asking, she's like, are they socialist? I'm like, not really, but they're not capitalist either. There's something so different.
Again, binary. Yeah. You're either this or that.
And they process things in such a different way. And I learn from mine all the time. I'm like, oh, they'll be like, mom, that's kind of, you know, that's outdated. And I'll be like, oh, thank you for correcting me.
It's funny. You're right. We get drawn into our news feeds and news cycles and whatever platform we use. And you know, whether it be a podcast interview and Jonathan Haidt or someone else, and you think, oh, this is a cursed generation. Every time I meet someone, whether they be, say, Gen Z or Gen Alpha, I'm full of hope. Mm-hmm. I do. You go, wow, what incredibly insightful, thoughtful, mature, considerate, not necessarily I don't know if I would agree that they're all technologically literate, but yes, they're definitely connected. But I think, yeah, we fall into this trap of making huge assumptions on the basis of some small sample size and some data that we're given rather than the reality.
Who's getting the research grants to study how Gen Z is going to change the world? Nobody's funding the research to talk about how different they are in positive ways, because I don't think we can even understand them in the sense that they are growing up in a truly different world with very different understandings, with very different mentalities and priorities. Like, there, a lot of them are deeply concerned that the planet is in massive danger, and they care about it to the point where they're willing to change their behaviors to participate in ways of restoring it. So I mean, I always look at where the funding's coming from or why somebody would be interested in this question. They think so differently that I don't even know that we know what questions to ask them. Like, I get brought in to do, you know, parenting and seminars, and like, how do we deal with social media and our kids? Cause I'm one of the only people know who talks about this. And I always use the example, like, when people are like, well, what, you know, when you ask your kid, like, what do you think about social media? They'll be like, what are you talking about? It'd be like asking us what we thought about TV when we were watching our Saturday morning cartoons. Like, there's no answer to that question. It's just their world. And so they don't have the same perception that we have about any of this stuff. And every time media literacy or digital literacy comes up, I've become increasingly convinced what people mean when they say that is that they want Gen Z to be literate in the same way X and above are, or millennials and above are. And that doesn't even make sense in Gen Z's world. In a world where print papers are dying on a daily basis, teaching them how to read a print paper or making them read social media the way they'd read a print paper. Like, if you start to think about it, it actually makes no sense. But it's trying to hold on to something, I think, that the world has so rapidly changed that for us to understand it, we're trying to make them understand it our way. So I often say, I wish that we had more intergenerational communication to have Gen Z be our guides and alpha to talk with them about what's important to them or how they see the world or why this tool, how they use the tools. Because if we keep thinking we know how to help them, we're missing the fact that they can help us.
Yeah, I think it's a balance to strike. I mean, there is clearly we have the systemic change that's happening within things like your industry, journalism, and what's happening with what is news and how what's the value of news in today's world? What does it really mean? Is it just a mechanism for maintaining the status quo, the social order, and, you know, the controllers and the controlled? And, you know, so I think there's, you know, a lot of issues that we're not going to be able to cover in this podcast, but I agree there. I am more hopeful for the future because of the generations that I encounter. I met this, you know, these charity people that are often called charity muggers that stand and try and get you to pay money to be part of a charity. Well, there's a lot of them there here at South by Southwest, but I got talking to one girl called Roz, and she's a fascinating young woman. 22-year-old, not sure what she wants to do, started out in a career in automotive and decided that wasn't for her, is now searching for meaning in her life. And, you know, I was just chatting to her and asking her about her thoughts on social media and how she consumes information. And she doesn't have a smartphone. She only reads books, doesn't read newspapers, and actively is against any form of social media, but she wants to consume the wisdom of the past in books and information, and will only consume information from friends and family that she trusts, but actually sort of rejects all these mainstream channels. So again, I think we can often fall into the trap of making gross generalizations about the behavior and of different generations that we're not really a part of. Mm-hmm. So I think there might be, you know, many sort of splintering sort of factions within that generation of how they're behaving and how they're deciding to change the world and reject the past generations' regulations and behaviors and standards. So I think, and quite right as well. I mean, every generation has a right to rebel, and there needs to be more rebellion within this generation growing up in the punk generation for me, and going, why aren't there more punks around today that rejecting the norms of culture? Too many people accepting them. You wrote something recently on LinkedIn where you talked about Clay Shirky's book. Well, I think he wrote it around 2010.
It was 2008, 12,
maybe 11.
Sure.
Oh, was it 2008?
I think it
wrote
was.
It? Yeah. Well, I've yeah,
or 2009.
I've got the book.
I mean, so it was a long time ago.
Yeah. Which is Here Comes Everybody.
Yeah.
I got him to sign it at South by Southwest. So it would have been around 2009. Yeah. I've got a copy of it. And that was a time when there was much hope and optimism around what the impact of social media would actually do in the world and how the internet was going to bring everyone together. And it was this great utopian vision, and not much thought was given to the dystopian side and how it would actually create more discourse and how, instead of bringing us closer together, it would lead us to be pulled further apart. I think in that post, I'm just going to read it. You finished that post writing. When we share the world we want to see, we increase our network's awareness of whatever it is we want them to know and believe to be possible. We also discover who in our network shares our hopes, and by engaging with them, we increase our connections to other people with similar vision and passion. Together, we can build a better world. And I think that was a lovely way of capturing the positive potential of using these technologies for good. Again, it still requires some form of behavior change. But the one thing I think is interesting that we haven't really touched on yet, the rapid acceleration of AI, and going back to, I talked about South by Southwest, the one thing that happened here, every session I went to had some aspect of it was all about AI. And if there was not, I don't think anyone has an answer of what the future is going to be like. Everyone's got an opinion, of course. Mm. But the one thing that united everyone at South by Southwest was the perspective or the point of view that there needs to be some rediscovering of who we are as human beings individually and collectively as AI starts to evolve to take on so many of the tasks, the roles, the purpose of what we do in work. And with the rapid rise of robots, it will accelerate even further. So maybe with the impact of AI and the imperative to discover our humanity and what you're saying, this need to express and what we know is possible and to share it with our networks, maybe that's what will result in us starting to listen to each other and start to talk to each other again, not talk at, but talk with each other. And I'm just wondering if maybe going back to what you were saying about this generation, maybe that conversation's already started and we're just not hearing it.
I think the dystopian side of all of this, I don't think is related to the technology itself. I think it's in the ideas of the systems we're living under. They always had the seeds of their own destruction sown into them because they were based on exploitative, competitive, selfish ideas, right? And so when I look at AI, and I think I totally agree that we need to discover who are we if we don't have to work, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah.
But a very utopian ideal would be that AI would take away any job that a human doesn't want to do and doesn't have to do anymore because AI could do it, right? Then who are you? Do you get to finally create and be who you want to be? I mean, you can get to the same concepts through things like universal basic income, but for so long, our stories had to define humans by their work because that was the story that made everything go. And so when people worry about the future of work because of things like AI or who do we become or future creativity because of AI, I think that people that have not stopped to think about, were humans really designed to do work for corporations, for governments, is that really our highest and best purpose? Or is that just where we've been stuck for a while because that's been the dominant structure that we've lived under? I was reading something recently about Picasso and why if Picasso could paint in the style of the old masters, did he choose to paint Picasso? And there was discussion of the fact that photography had come on board. And so realism in painting was no longer a thing that was necessary because a machine could make realistic replicas, but no machine makes Picasso. And so I think we're going to see a lot more of that kind of what is human self-expression or human cultural collaborative expression that AI can't create. AI can generate the mediocre. It can troll and it can combine, but it can't spontaneously create. And that's what humans do. And just...
Exactly. So we could be... I mean, our previous guest, Dave Burrs, talked about that, about AI and how it will spark, you know, with how photography, when photography came in, that's when a lot of the painters moved away from realism to expressionism and cubism like Picasso. And the same way that with what's possible in film now with Sora when it's finally released and what's possible with all the different AI creative tools, it will potentially generate the next generation of human creativity, of things that, so I think, and that's where, again, there's a division of opinion around that. I went to another talk at South by Southwest by Zachary Levi, an actor who's in the movie a couple of years ago, one of these action movies. And he just said, we have to reinvent. And he's building studios outside of Austin to try and reimagine with other creators what the future of entertainment and what content and creation is going to be. Didn't know what the answer was, but he knew that the AI was coming for their jobs. And he said, the only choice we have is to reimagine or give up.
For me, I'm mostly optimistic. I think all of this is exciting. One of the points I really appreciated in Clay Shirky's book is the democratization of creation, that for so long in so many fields, you weren't allowed to create if you didn't have money and you didn't have access, because it required specialized training at specialized schools with specialized people. And now everybody can create something, maybe not at the same skill level as somebody who's mastered the principles or the techniques, but we can try. Like when we started giving crayons to all children, that was a huge leap to creativity. That didn't used to be something all children had access to. And now we don't even think twice about the fact that crayons are part of childhood development. And that's going to be true of all sorts of creative tools through AI. And so I'm excited about stuff like this, because I think that one of the biggest drawbacks to the stories we've been living under, as John Alexander points out, is who gets to participate in those stories. And yes. So many people's ideas have not been at the table because they didn't even have the avenues to get there. And so I don't know how many budding filmmakers there were in the 1930s who couldn't access film equipment, that we don't have their creations because they weren't able to ever get anywhere where they could make the things that were in their head. So that's the stuff that I'm like, I can't wait to see what stories have never been told, because the only people who can tell them haven't had the tools to tell them and are starting to get those tools.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm part of a group here in Austin called the Austin Entertainment Business, and they did an event the other month about the risk of AI to everyone's jobs. And, you know, I spoke to the guy on his podcast afterwards called The R Snake Show and made the argument, actually, I disagree with you, Robert. I don't think it is going to be the death of the entertainment business. What will happen? Yes, the studios will embrace all the AI tools. They'll use ways to save money, to reduce the cost of production, and they'll still manage the means of distribution. But it will change, because there will be a whole new generation of people, as you say, that will have this new democratization and means of production to create boundless types of new forms of ideas in new formats, in new distribution channels that we've never imagined before. And it will probably lead to an explosion of a reimagining of theater that brings the creative ideas that can be expressed through the use of AI and then brought to a stage in the physical realm in a way that we've never seen before. And I think it's just really, I think it's fascinating. And I think it's really exciting as to what lies ahead.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Going back to, I think in the questions I mentioned, Rutger Bregman, the brilliant Dutch journalist who wrote the book Humankind, where he's a line in the book where he talks about the survival of the friendliest. And what you have talked about are trying to create modes of behavior and a sort of, I suppose, protocols to create more friendly, embracing, respectful online behaviors. But I wonder if what we are going to see is an emergence of people spending more time away from the digital social space in the physical space. And the reason I mention it, recently here, I've encountered a few people that have started to create these new meetups. One was called Borderless Walks, which is in people who want to get away from feeling disconnected online, going out on these walks around the boardwalk at Lady Bird Lake in Austin. And they all just hang out together and you get paired one-on-one with someone you don't know. And you go for these long walks along the boardwalk, boardwalks, and anything but boring. And then the other one is a guy who I met at an event here during South by Southwest, who's created a thing called the Bookless Book Clubs, where he brings people together who have all got a love of books, but not to sit and read books, but just sort of chat and create discourse. And the same with the Austin entertainment business, where people come together and exchange their knowledge, their skills, their ideas in physical spaces. And I think, you know, that I think we're all naturally have the gene, the kindness gene, the friendly gene. We all want to be loved and love. And I think what we're seeing is I think the work you're doing is great, because it is making people rethink and reconsider their online behavior. But at the same time, post-COVID, post everything that's happening, alongside maybe the discourse that people are seeing online, I think we might see a resurgence of in-person events where we can start to create more positive discourse and storytelling experiences and not debates. Mm-hmm. That's my hope for the future.
I think it's an and. I think the two are symbiotic, in that when you need to enter a space and you're uncertain, the digital world gives you the ability to do that in a safe place, right? Like, you can drop in on a live streamed meeting that you might not want to go to in person, or you could interact with people from a particular view, or just not even interact. You can just consume content from people that you might not know how to talk to in an in-person setting. And I've talked to a handful of people over the years that are on the autism spectrum, say that it's a lot easier to go meet somebody in person that they've already interacted with online, because they already know about that person, and they don't have to explain to them in person, hey, this is who I am and this is how I do stuff. So I think it adds to our world instead of subtracts. And I think that's a lot of what I try to talk about is so much of the doom and gloom is like that it took away, it ruined, it destroyed, it messed up. And I'm like, no, it gave us options that we didn't exist before. Or if you're unable to go outside for various reasons, like you're sick or you have certain conditions, you can still connect with people and still have socialization when for some reason, for other reasons in the physical world, you can't. So you couldn't do that before. So now we have both. We can do both. And I think that that's great, because there are going to be some places when I very much want to be. I sort of liken it to this. When I was at UT Austin, I was a journalism major. I had a 500-person chemistry class. Perfect. I didn't want to be in chemistry class. I didn't want to talk about chemistry. I didn't want to connect with anybody in chemistry. I just wanted to go get my credit, move on with my life. Ideal. But I had 12 people in my Spanish phonetics class, and smaller numbers in a lot of my journalism classes where I did want to connect. So I love the fact that we now have the ability to be anonymous or distant when we need to or want to, but also the ability to be intimate and really get to know people in physical spaces too. So I like both of them.
No, I do as well. I'm just thinking that always with actions is a reaction. And we've seen things change recently, and the actions that have been triggered because of the pandemic will create a reaction. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how things emerge. Can you tell me about the Digital Kindness Journal and what it is?
So when I wrote my first two books, I was thinking about, okay, I've been trained in the way of concise writing, where you communicate a point, persuasive writing, or
embracing brevity.
Yeah. So it was a communication tool. I was trying to get my ideas across, but I also developed all these questions for each, the end of each chapter, because I wanted people to discuss, right? I feel like so many things in life, we need to actually bounce our ideas off of other people and be like, hey, what do you think about this? So in my kind of learning and journey, I keep trying to figure out different ways for different brains. And some people are never going to read something. They don't want my voice in their head. So I created the journal as a guided way of answering questions, so that a person can just sort of work their way through various things in online spaces, so they can formulate their own approach. Because a lot of my work is not to say this is what you have to do, or here's how to do it, or I don't believe in one size fits all.
Just an example of what would you encounter in it?
Oh, I have it right here. Okay. So I didn't like my microphone is too big. So there's like prompts. Like here's one that just says, list the friends, creators, content that you follow and rate them on a scale of 1 to 10 of 1, we disagree on everything, or 10, we agree on everything. And what do you notice? So some people are going to notice that they are following a very diverse set of people, and other people are going to notice that they only follow the same ideas. And they get to decide whether they want to add more or less to their feeds. But just to have this, to walk through a series of questions of like, how am I actually using this? Instead of being reactionary, being more purposeful about, oh, I didn't realize that every time I'm online, I actually don't feel good. Like, what's that about? When I got offline today, I felt terrible. Why? And so there's just a series of, I think there's like 50 plus of those types of questions. And then there's daily practice. And the daily practice are things like, if I find one, how I felt in digital spaces today, what I posted today, the positive content I saw and my responses, or negative content I saw, my responses, things I learned. Cause that's one, you know, a goal that people can set for themselves in online spaces. What do I not know about? What do I feel kind of uncertain about? Like so many things that I know about now is because it crossed my feed at some point and I was like, I don't know what that is. Maybe I should spend some more time trying to figure out what that's all about and learning in a very passive way just by intentionally consuming more content about a topic that I didn't know anything about. I don't know if I mentioned this, but I grew up in a climate denying world. Even though I lived in Austin, my subculture was very climate change denying. And so I've had to learn all of that as an adult.
Whoa.
I know. And I would say things in normal person conversation and they'd look at me like, what? And I started to realize, oh, I'm clearly not on the same page as people. So I should at least figure out what I'm saying and whether I actually understand anything I'm talking about. Or is this just something I inherited from my surroundings, right? So that's something that I spent a lot of time learning. A kind thing I did online, other reflections, time you spent there. So just a way of tracking, really being purposeful about, okay, this is what I'm doing in these spaces. This is what I'm getting from these spaces. This is what I would like to get from these spaces. And this is what I would like to put into these spaces. Because one of the questions is like, what experiences of mine might be helpful to somebody else? So to your storytelling point, right? Our stories, the things that we go through, somebody else is going through something similar. And I think about so many things that have been destigmatized. Like, I mean, mental health alone. This was not something people talked about openly.
I know. If you think about it, even like 15 years ago.
And now to say that, like openly say, and one of the reasons why I do say it in almost every interview I do, every podcast I go on, is because I come from a world where that was not an acceptable thing. I'm supposed to pray to make everything better, right? And so I always consider that there's somebody who's watching or listening who needs to hear it in this setting. Yeah. So, and because it doesn't scare me to say it, I mean, there was a time when it would have scared me to openly say it. Now I can. And that means somebody else is going to be able to access that. And who knows if that's going to be the thing that's the day that they make the call that will help, you know?
It sort of leads on to the question I was going to ask about what challenges have you faced or had to overcome on your journey? That seems to be an obvious one.
Yes.
Yeah.
You overcome a worldview that tells you how you're supposed to behave, how you're supposed to show up, who you're allowed to be.
Yeah.
What you're allowed to dream of. Like, I think I was reading an affirmation. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. I think I pronounced it correctly. A Nahuatl prayer. I'm not sure if I said it right. It's an indigenous culture.
How'd you spell that?
I think it's N-A-H-A-U-T-L. I think it's related to Aztec culture. Watch, somebody's gonna be like, absolutely not. She's completely wrong. But it's an indigenous culture for sure. And the prayer said something like, I free my children from my expectations so that they can be who they are meant to be, or something like that, right? And it also says, I forgive my parents. There's this whole thing about ancestors and children, but the one that resonates with me so strongly is that freeing my children to be who they are. Because I love my parents, we have a great relationship, but there were very clear expectations about who and what I was going to be. And some of them I fulfilled and some of them I very much didn't. But there was a lot of having to find myself in that process, because to your point about certainty, when you're stamped with certainty, even when you're uncertain, if it fits you, it's really hard to not be it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say challenges, one of the biggest challenges for me has been being me, which sounds strange mm-hmm. to say, but I've had to, it takes a lot of work, and therapy is a tool and journaling is a tool to identify who I actually am, what is actually important to me, and how I want to show up in the world. Because there's this programming that's running in the background. it's less.
Do you think the thing you said at the beginning when I asked you who you are as a human being, you said, I'm a thinker. I didn't quite understand it when you said that. But now it sort of does sort of make sense that you've almost deprogrammed yourself from the default settings that were conditioned into you to become an independent thinker. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. Because I was always a good student, right? Like I could learn anything that somebody poured into me. But to be able to mm-hmm. think originally and not just synthesize, that took a long time. And so my partner, he's just one of these people that's 100% himself, right? So I'm in awe of him and the way that he navigates mm-hmm. the world and the way that he should. Like he doesn't even think twice about what he's saying or what he's doing or what he's wearing. I mean, he's also a very kind, like wonderful person. So that characteristic in a not nice person can be a problem. But like we went somewhere one time and he did so. I don't remember what he did, but I was like, so the reason I didn't want to do this, because this is the dialogue that went on in my head. And I started explaining like all the second guessing of what this other person would think and like how I needed to behave and how, and he was just like, the worst thing they could do is say no. And it was one of those moments where I was like, oh, other people don't have that inner dialogue going on in the same way that I do all the time, where I'm thinking through 70 different scenarios, or my initial reaction is this, but then I have to remember that that's not the reaction that I want to have. I actually want to do this thing instead. It's, mm-hmm. it's like my therapist at one point, she's like, it's exhausting. But I mean, it does enable the strategic type of thought, right? Like to map mm-hmm. certain things out or to ask certain questions or things like that.
Mm. I also want to mention, I got this, again, another guest, this guy called Stephen Hecht, got this book called Nonflict.
Oh, cool.
And it's a conflict resolution thing in 4 key steps. And one of the first steps is to be able to put yourself in someone else's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he's had huge success with this around the world, and from everything from prior to the current conflict in Israel and Palestine with Israelis and Palestinians. But what I really liked about one of his things, I went through the program with him. He said, you know, when we get into situations where there's potential conflict, we either flee the conflict, we either fight it, so we get into real sort of conflict. We fold when we get into that situation sometimes, or we try and sort of reach some sort of 50-50 where no one's happy. But the way that we ultimately usually solve things is when we get into some sort of co-creation situation, when we can build something together. And I really like that. And I think that's where, in a way, again, we talked about, you said, you know, there's going back to that woman you talked about from the military debate and dialogue. You know, you get into a situation where we can tell stories with each other. That's one way. But when we actually start to make things with each other, that's when I think real connection happens. So, you know, that's, I think, another area I just think for us all to reflect on is how can we get into a space, a virtual space and not physical space, where we can be about co-creation, not necessarily of physical things, but just co-creation of ideas, of concepts, of solving problems together. Because I think that clearly what Stephen's learned from all these workshops that he's done with people, when people come together and they co-create, they work together, they step into each other's shoes and they help each other. It unlocks our kindness gene. It unlocks our empathy for each other. So yeah, I just wanted to mention that.
I love that. I think we need more spaces like that.
Oh, without question. I'm conscious of time. So I want to get some personal questions. Not that it hasn't been personal. who or what, other than your kids, inspires you? Or what inspires you?
Currently, I love Adrienne Marie Brown. Everything that she puts out into the world just stops me in my tracks.
Okay.
it's from such a different perspective than I come from, but it's really moving to me. And I think that she's managed to carve a space for herself in a world that would not always be receptive to what she has to say. So, and she's the first person that came to mind, but I look to those people that seem to be doing themselves in community, regardless of whether it makes any sense from a traditional perspective or a fiscal perspective or whatever, and that it seems to be working, like people are finding it. So that's anybody who's just sort of doing their own different thing and making their mark, but bringing people together doing it. I love that stuff.
That's cool. I'll check out Adrienne Murray Brown. What principles do you live by?
Take care of myself and be kind to others. Pretty much it.
Nice, simple, easy to follow. How do you deal with uncertainty and self-doubt?
That's like a lifelong journey for me. When you mentioned anxiety in the younger generation, like it was only a couple of years ago that I realized, oh, I think I actually have anxiety. Like that, and I've always had it because I can go back. I have journals from when I was in high school, and I will describe this just like pit of fear of nothing specific at all, just this dread. And I don't even think back then I would have been able to explain it to somebody. I'm not sure that anybody would have been able to help me if I'd started explaining it. But a couple years ago, I had an actual like anxiety attack for the first time, like a real, like one where I was like, I can't ignore this. And so I had, that's some of why I was in therapy and other reasons. So I've had to learn how to manage it. It's always sort of there, but I try to stay grounded in like, this is the present moment. I'm fine right now. I might not have been fine 5 minutes ago, and I might not be fine 5 minutes from now, but I'm okay right now. I'll also just trying to be, to see the optimism in things, that things will not always be like this, that whatever the moment currently is, or the challenge currently is, there's a point beyond it. So it's, I mean, it's an ongoing process for me.
I think for all of us, a weight to it. I don't know if I like the word legacy, but you know, you are working to leave an impact in the world with the work you're doing, but what would you like that impact or legacy to be?
I used to think that I wanted it to be that people figured out a way to use these online spaces more productively, like in positive human ways. Now I think I'm a transitional person, that my real work will be in helping people see why we should be allowing Gen Z and Gen Alpha to be occupying spaces and leading discussions. So really, mic passing is probably my legacy.
I like that. Yeah, well, with the elections that are happening in the world at the moment, it's about bloody time we just pass that mic on, particularly in this country.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, okay. Well, all power to you to make that happen sooner rather than later. Any book that you would recommend for other than yours that people should read?
Yes, there was two of them that I was thinking about. One is The Dawn of Everything. I forget, it's Graeber and Wingrow. And it's a kind of different anthropological, archaeological look at the stories we tell about our history. And they look at the hopeful, collaborative, the societies we were talking about, the non-hierarchical, more flat and more egalitarian, for lack of a better word. I'm using words that only make sense in our world, but
yeah.
So they take a look at all of these stories that none of us know because they haven't trickled into mainstream consciousness because they don't fit the narrative of competition and exploitation. And so, I mean, and of course, there's reactions to it and people don't all think that it's the greatest scholarship ever, but I don't care because I love the fact that it gives a different perspective of who we are as humans and different answers to how we can do this as people. Mm-hmm. And also when you mentioned Hobbes and Rousseau, like the opening chapters are about Hobbesian Rousseauian concepts of community and social interactions and critiquing it from an indigenous perspective. It's fascinating. Nothing I learned in school.
Okay.
And then the other one is The Web of Meaning. I can't remember what the subtitle is, but it has something to do with science and nature. I can't remember. But anyway, it's all about, again, where our science, we've only told certain stories through science about selfish genes and competition. And the real data that we have from nature is that there's collaboration and sort of weaving Western philosophy and ideology with Eastern philosophy and with what we know now from more of our scientific studies to kind of where we might go in the future. It has, its last chapter is very hopeful about like, what does this mean for us as humans and how do we take care of our planet? And So just telling a different story about all the stories we've always heard, looking at it from a different perspective of interdependence instead of domination and independence. And he uses the analogy of harmony that, you know, with harmony, everything's kind of doing its own thing, but it's all working together like jazz. So it's just, those are the things that give me hope.
Okay. It sounds good. I'm not familiar with either. So put them on the list to read. Any show, documentary, movie that is important for people to watch that you've seen?
The two that I'm sort of obsessed with right now, Better Things, which is an FX series. It's streaming on Hulu. And Atlanta, also an FX series streaming on Hulu. They're both, I didn't realize this when I was watching Better Things at first. I was drawn to Better Things because it's about a single mom raising three children. She's also in the entertainment industry. I didn't realize that what it was a surrealistic examination of things. And then Atlanta also is. It's more surrealistic examination of the Black experience in America. And so they're not at all similar. And yet they are in that both of the creators are just making what makes sense to them. And it doesn't fit a format. Like, it's not linear often. It doesn't do like episodic character arc type things. And yet you see growth, you see change, you see, it's almost like vignettes in these people's lives. But it can be disconcerting at first because you're like, what am I watching? And then once you get the rhythm of it, they're both fascinating. And especially, I haven't finished Atlanta, but Better Things. It's just really beautiful. It's about found family and made family and how you create spaces of belonging. I mean, it doesn't say it's about that, but that's what it is. And how you make people feel seen and heard and valued and loved. And anyway, I love them both.
Okay. Those will go in the show notes. What about a life hack that you think would be a behavior change that someone could embrace, if any?
Mine is that I have no idea what I'm doing in most situations, and I'm just going to have to figure it out as I go along, and it's going to be okay.
Oh, I'm sure your kids probably love that philosophy in life as well.
Sometimes. Sometimes they love it, and other times they're like, aren't you supposed to be the grown-up? Aren't you supposed to have all the answers?
Yeah, well, if it's about mic passing, you go, no, there you go. Exactly. You take over.
What do you think about that?
Okay, I always ask the permission question to if you're open to me engineering random collisions between like-minded guests. So if you are, we'll do that.
Absolutely. That's the coolest thing. I love the name of this podcast and I love what you're doing to do.
Okay, well, look out once the episode's live for some random collisions.
Perfect.
And the final question is... throwing it back to you, is who do I interview next from your network?
I wasn't sure if you'd heard of him before, but I would interview Jeremy Lent. I think the one that wrote The Web of Meaning. I think he's fascinating. And I think I've never met him, but I think you'd have an amazing conversation. He was a Silicon Valley exec, like a startup founder. Mm-hmm.
But you don't know him.
I don't know him. I want you to interview him so that you can introduce him to me.
Well, I'll try and do that, but you have to also connect me with someone that you know you think it would be interesting. Tell me now.
Okay.
You can think about it.
I'll think about it. I'll definitely give you names.
But I'll put Jeremy Lent.
L-E-N-T.
Lent. Jeremy Lent. Okay. I'll put Jeremy Lent on my list and manifest that to happen. So there you go.
Okay. I'll think of one that I can actually connect you with.
Excellent. Right. Well, thank you very much, Lauren, for your sharing your thoughts, your thinking. It's quite clear as independent. And just the work that you're doing, I think it's inspiring.
Thank you.
And definitely sort of align with your conviction that it's time for us to pass on the mic to the younger generation to start coming up with some better ideas and better thinking and better policies and reimagining of society as AI starts to consume us as humans. So look forward to following what happens with your story.
Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, that's all for now, folks. Now here's my ask of you. Please follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or whatever player you use. Also, please subscribe to our new Random Collisions newsletter. We really are working to build a global community of action takers, action engines of people that really care about the problems that need solving. Thank you very much, and see you next time.